You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
From Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the art history babes.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Natalie.
I'm Jen.
And I'm Ginny. And we are the art history babes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're all together again.
Finally.
To me.
So all four of us are back, which is exciting. What's everyone been up to? How was your trip, Nat?
It was good. Mount Shasta was great. I love it up there. I'm going to take you guys.
Yes.
Eventually.
Did Definitely. You climb the mountain?
Not this time. You know, it's only
climb
like
the mountain.
It's only like a 12-hour endeavor, you know.
That reminds me of New Girl.
Oh, yeah, it goes to climb
Mount Shasta.
Yeah. I forgot that it was Mount Shasta.
Yeah, she goes to climb Mount Shasta to get over Schmidt.
Which is one way to do it, I guess.
Yeah, right.
She doesn't end up doing either, so, you know. But no, it was great. Went to Calistoga, Napa, went to the Hess Collection.
I love the Hess Collection.
So good.
So did you do one of those, like, mineral mud baths?
God, yeah.
You did?
Have you guys ever done one?
No!
That's like my dream.
God, so
what is this you life think, you're living?
Okay, so you think like mineral mud bath, you're gonna walk in like a spa and it's gonna smell like tea tree.
No,
and,
it
like,
smells not good.
No, it literally smells like manure.
We watched it. We're like, what the fuck did we get ourselves into?
It's like manure and sulfur. And then they're like, okay, now get naked and get in there. But like, you can't get in feet first because the bottom's too hot, so you have to like slide in.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of go in like butt first?
Yeah, it's like a big tub with like the flat edges, so you have to kind of like lay on it. And I'm there with my mom and her boss, and like all just like naked, like sliding into this mud.
Did you see your mom's naked boss?
Yeah.
All right. I just needed to know. I needed to know if that happens.
It's interesting. We should do it.
We could do it.
We could do.
We'll podcast live from the mud bath.
We out here
at the mud bath.
After that, did it feel good,
but not extraordinary. Mm. I don't know. Nothing soft.
I'm living vicariously through you.
Before we get into, you know, the art history stuff, want to give a shout out to Sam for our awesome intro song.
Sam.
We're so excited because we've really been wanting an intro song since we started, basically. And Sam just came up with something and we were like, 100% yes, Sam.
Yeah, she put it together and
you nailed it.
She nailed it. It's so good.
Sam, if you're listening, it was so good and we're so happy. And to our listeners, check out Sam's music on her SoundCloud.
So today we're talking about color theory, which is a really crazy, exciting rabbit hole that we're going down. Like,
it gets weird.
It does. It gets really weird, guys. So because it's such a big topic, we're going to do a two-parter. So we're going to kind of start with talking about the science-y side of color perception, which is also kind of the philosophical side of color. They kind of intersect. So I'm just going to throw some science at you real quick. What is color exactly? We didn't really understand it until the 1600s. In 1672, Isaac Newton published his experiments in color perception, which is a lot of the information we currently know about color perception. The most well-known was he used a prism to prove that light alone was responsible for color. So it's the light that creates our perception of color, and color exists in our minds. So that's just a trippy idea, really, when you think about it.
Yeah. And that's the cover of a Pink Floyd album, by the way, which can't get any trippier than that.
You really can't. Dark Side of the Moon. Right there. Isn't it Dark Side of the Moon?
I think so. Yeah.
So yeah, nothing about an object that you look at is inherently a color. If you look at a blueberry, it's not inherently blue. what happens is that color is perceived in our mind by reflected light. So perception of a specific wavelength of visual light is what's happening. The light reflects off into your eyes, and then you see the color in your mind, which is trippy.
Mm-hmm. That is so hard for me to wrap my mind around.
I know, right?
Like, when I think about it, I think I want to look at the things in our world outside of my brain. Like, I want to know, what do they look like
outside of
my brain? I don't know.
Without my perception. Exactly. So, yeah, it can really lead to some crazy philosophical thoughts and questions. But, okay, so kind of breaking it down a little more scientifically. Visible light is part of the electromagnetic spectrum. The visible spectrum are the spectral colors, which are the colors of the rainbow. So, visible light, visible spectrum, spectral colors, rainbow. Pigments create color, in a sense. So, for example, like in carrots, the pigment that makes a carrot look orange are carotenoids. And what a pigment does is it absorbs some of the wavelengths of light and it reflects back others. And the light reflected back is the color that you see. So a pigment is just absorbing and reflecting light, and that's how it creates a color. Does that make sense?
My astronomy professor from undergrad, Dr. Olson, thank you. That's what I'm seeing right now, because there's like the different colors, and if I'm wrong, correct me, but they're different lengths, right?
Yes.
So like red is the longest.
Yep.
If you were to rank colors by like what we're able to absorb, that's like the first color, I guess you would say. Be like red, and what's the shortest? Isn't it like
blue is the shorter end of the spectrum. So yeah, red at one end, blue at the other.
Yeah, so
and then green, like, kind of in the middle.
Think like squiggly lines, and then like longer ones and shorter ones.
And that's why when an object is coming at you, you see more red light, and when it's going away, it's more blue.
Yeah.
And there's theory about that, like with paintings. So like colors that kind of pop out in paintings versus colors that recede. Right?
Sure. Yeah. So what's happening in your eyes when you're perceiving color? Your cones are your color perceiving cells. So we all know we have rods and cones in our eyes. Cones are the ones that perceive color, and there's significantly less cones than there are rods. You have about 6 million cones in each eye. So it's still a lot of cones, but that's what perceives color.
Thank you, cones.
Shout out to all the cones out there.
Humans are considered trichromats, which means we see everything through blue, red, and green channels. So the cones in our eyes, they either see blue, red, or green. They all kind of have a different purpose. They say blue, red, or green. And then the combinations of the different cones working together is how we see other colors. Mm-hmm. Humans can see somewhere between 2.38 million and 10 million colors.
Whoa.
There's a lot of different science on it. From what I heard, because I got a lot of this information off of this really great podcast done by Stuff You Should Know called How Color Works. Check that out if you want more, because they do a really great full episode on just kind of color optics and color theory.
We also just love them.
Yeah, we love them a lot. That podcast said that the best science that's been done on it says 2.38 million. But there's other science that suggests up to like 10 million. So it's a lot of colors. There's a lot of colors
like,
we can see.
How do they even test that?
That's like anything. Like it's a spectrum. So certain people see more colors than other people, which is just a trip anyway.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, color blindness, color deficiency is a very common thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you even really measure color deficiency? Because technically color deficiency just means you can't tell the difference between certain shades of color.
It's on the gradient of color blindness.
Yeah. But the whole like color perception thing, it's so interesting because really any two people could see color in a more intense or less intense way. Like it's such a big spectrum of how we see color.
And then wouldn't color be inherently subjective then, since we're making it in our brains?
Right.
What? Which kind of brings me to this next idea. Shout out to another of our favorite podcast, This American Life. We're all big This American Life fans. Mm-hmm. And there was an episode not too long ago called Something Only I Can See. And it opens with the story of this guy who he had issue with like vessels bleeding behind his eye or something. So he had to get,
lovely.
I know, right? He had to get surgery. So he got this surgery and the doctors used lasers to kind of fix this problem. And then one day, post-surgery, he comes inside after he was outside in the cold. And it took his eyes some time to adjust. And he saw a color that he describes as a green that could never exist, which is like...
interesting.
Yeah, right? So then Ira Glass is interviewing him and like asking him to try to keep explaining this color. He goes on to say, if the color black was fluorescent and green. And that's like the...
Yeah. Whoa.
Right?
That's kind of like my nails.
Mystery solved.
Yeah, I got it right here, actually. Sorry, bro. It's called Raven.
The whole episode's really good and really interesting, but it's kind of like, you know, how do you explain a color only you've seen? How do you do that? It speaks a lot to the subjectivity of color experience. And even just speaking from a personal perspective, I think my color proficiency has improved over the years. Like, I feel like I see colors better now than I did before. Like, I feel like that's something, especially being in art history, and like we study images and we look at color and we think about color. I honestly think when I look at a sunset now, it looks different than it did 5 years ago.
Philosophical question. So because we know that color is of the mind and not necessarily like real, do you think it's just the fact that you notice it more now and that you learn to vocalize what you're seeing more than you would have before because we look and talk about so much? Or do you think that you genuinely see more than you did?
I think it's a combination. I mean, because all of our experiences change us and make us aware of new things. I think it's just, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about color now, so it just makes me more aware. I think it's maybe an increase in awareness. Is a good way to
put it. Well, you know, what I've noticed coming into my middle and later 20s is that there are some colors now that I seriously can't stand.
Like what?
Like, I hate yellow.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yellow makes me so uncomfortable, and it grates on my...
your
eyeballs. My senses.
Like all yellow? Like even like that?
More no, like ochre-y, no, or just no. Like ochre yellow, is yellow. Fine, but let's say, for instance, the color of the koozie that our good friend Zach made for us, that kind of highlighter yellow. Mm. I mean, you guys probably haven't noticed, but I never use the yellow highlighter.
Interesting now that you say that.
Yeah, I always do like the green because yellow just makes me so... Yeah,
like a visceral reaction.
I do. Yeah. I feel like... you know, like that's the best way to describe it. I'm just like, I don't like it. And I didn't have that as a kid, so I don't know what that's all
about. That's interesting.
Yeah. I dipped my toe into the psychology pool of all of this. Yeah, just a toe. But they talk about how red and yellow are the easiest colors for really, really young children to digest. So like young children tend to be drawn towards red and yellow more than any other color.
That makes sense.
I like
those
red.
Are my favorite colors. And I was red and yellow were my favorite colors as a child.
Yeah,
like,
and that
easily.
Would totally make sense with what you were saying about waves and and the like length and red being the easiest to see.
Yeah, and that kind of segues nicely into color vocabulary. So we're kind of shifting from like the optical physics element of it into the words you use to talk about color in art. So, gonna talk about the color wheel a little bit. You've all probably seen one. It's probably in your like kindergarten classroom. So, the primary colors, red, blue, and yellow. Secondary colors exist from a combination of any of those two colors, and you get orange, green, and purple. And then you do the same thing again with secondary colors, and you get tertiary colors. Red, orange, red, purple, blue, green, yellow, green, and yellow, orange. So that's kind of your basic color wheel. The word hue, which we're all probably familiar with, is really just referring to the name of a color. It's kind of interchangeable with the color name itself. Saturation refers to the intensity of purity of a hue. So high saturation, it's going to be really bright. And desaturation, low saturation, is going to be a very washed out color. Value is the degree of lightness or darkness of a hue. And then there are three words that tend to be used interchangeably, but they actually shouldn't be. Shade, tint, and tone. Shade actually refers to adding black to a hue. Tint refers to adding white. And then tone refers to adding gray. So they don't all mean the same thing. They can have similar effects, but they mean different things in terms of color vocabulary. Temperature would refer to warm colors versus cool colors. Mm-hmm. So your warm colors are red, orange, yellows. Mm-hmm. Cool colors are purple, blues, and greens. Some general color schemes that are popular. A monochromatic scheme would just be one hue, and then you add white, black, and gray to that hue to create a monochromatic color scheme. Complementary colors sit across each other on the color wheel. Using complementary colors of equal intensity can result in what's considered color vibrations, what can kind of be like visual noise in the design world. So like if you put a green and a red of equal intensity next to each other, it's going to be intense. It's going to be really intense on your eyes. It's going to create what's considered a color vibration. So that's something to be aware of. People tend to think complementary colors, they must go great together. Mm. Not necessarily always true. Let's see. Another one is an analogous color scheme, which is 2 to 4 colors next to each other on the color wheel. So any 2 to 4 that all sit next to each other on the color wheel. A triadic color scheme is 3 colors that are evenly spaced around the color wheel. A split complementary scheme is a base color and 2 colors adjacent to its complementary color. That is honestly probably going to be more harmonious than trying to put together complementary colors.
Hmm.
So if you take like a color on the color wheel as your base color, and then you find its complementary color across the color wheel, and then you use the 2 colors on either side.
Oh, yeah. I remember learning about this.
Yeah, that's going to probably be a lot more harmonious and, like, nice on the eyes.
So next time you're painting your bathroom, keep this in mind.
Or next time you're, like, looking at an abstract painting and you start talking shit saying, like, I could do this. Think of all that artist had to learn by way of color theory. Memorize all this shit and learn it and have some damn appreciation for it.
Yeah, another one, the square color scheme, which is 4 complementary colors evenly spaced around the color wheel. I thought that was kind of an interesting one that I've never really employed.
I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, 4 evenly spaced colors around the color wheel. That's going to be a nice little color scheme for you. So try it.
Play with this sometime.
Yeah.
Just like, I feel like it'd be fun.
I wish we had a color wheel right now.
I know.
We'll put one on the website.
For a Pantone definitely. Book.
We do have a Pantone book.
Oh, yeah, we do. I'm going to talk about.
Oh, boy.
But yeah, before I talk about that, if you want some like visual examples of all those things I just talked about, there's this really great YouTube video, and we'll put it on our sources on our website. It's Simple Art Tips on YouTube, and it's just this like super cute girl with like awesome glasses, and she does a great job. So we'll put that up if you want some like visual examples as well to go along with all these color schemes and color wheel things. But Pantone, The 20th Century in Color, is an amazing book.
Can we just talk about what this book looks like, it's like before you even open
so
it?
So much fun.
It's just lovely. I just really love it.
No, it's great. But it's even better when you open it up because...
Oh my God, we're geeking out.
You should go to your local library, check it out. It's really cool.
Touch it.
What it does is it's in chronological order, and it examines essentially like important color palettes throughout the entire 1900s. Starts in 1900s, goes all the way to the 1990s.
Ooh, do they have that radium green?
Probably. But it goes through each decade. It hits on really important, not only important artists, but just important cultural, visual, like culture type things that happened in that decade. It's got like a little blurb about that thing and then images, and then it breaks down the color palette for you and tells you the exact shades. Like I just opened it up to, let's see, what decade was this? This was the 1940s. I just opened it up randomly. Fantasia is the first one. So you have these stills from Fantasia, which is an amazing film.
Oh, it is amazing.
God.
This is just like a brief side note. Kay Nielsen illustrated a lot of Fantasia. Fantastic artist. So I love Fantasia. But back to Fantasia.
Fantasia is great. I loved this movie when I was little, and mm-hmm. I think it was probably a hardcore indicator that I was going to be like a stony kid.
Yeah, me too. Because
I was just like so about it.
Right.
Like
that last part of the movie where it's like the devil and there's all the little dancing devil people coming out of the volcano.
That was my favorite part. Yeah. It was so cool.
Yes. Anyways, it's trippy but visually fantastic.
Yep.
So yeah, Fantasia, and then it's got these stills from Fantasia, and then it breaks down the color palette, like We've got bittersweet and golden cream and deep lichen green.
Aww.
And then, like, the next page is Edward Hopper, who was a very important artist in the 1940s, and it does the same thing for him. And then we have World War II, and it shows World War II propaganda posters, and then breaks that down. It's like,
we should do an episode on those alone.
I know, right? So it does this for the entire 20th century. I really like the 90s. They talk about, like, the grunge color palette, and, like,
do they talk about Nickelodeon?
I'm not sure.
Because that orange color will forever be in my mind.
The slime.
Yes, the slime.
Like that. Those two colors.
Disgusting,
man.
Like lime fluorescent.
That Shrek green.
But anyways, it's a great book. You should check it out. We'll also have it up on our sources as well on the website. So that's what I got for right now. I'm going to pass it over to Ginny. She's going to teach you a thing or two about the color blue, y'all.
Ooh, I'm so excited about the color blue. And I have so much to share with you on the color blue. So I'm going to open it with this. Yo, listen up. Here's a story about a little guy that lives in a blue world. And all day and all night and everything he sees is just blue. Like him inside and outside, blue his house with a blue little window and a blue Corvette. And everything is blue for him. And himself and everybody around, because he ain't got nobody to listen. I'm blue. Anyways, you all know that song. I mean, I'm sure a lot of you do. Eiffel 65, that was
so popular. Jam.
And you remember, like, your music videos were so trippy.
They were.
So shout out to you guys.
Thank you for that.
So, for this episode, I got really into blue, and I can't even exactly describe why. It just kind of happened. I mean, I guess I can pin it at the very least to my good friend David. David, this is a shout out to you, who was talking to me specifically about the color ultramarine, which I'll get into shortly, and how that color really kind of dominated the pigment color scheme of art, especially during the Renaissance. But before I get into that, what is so interesting about the color blue is that in the English language, it was one of the last colors to be added. So it came after yellow, it came after red, it came after green even. The beginnings were kind of like more of just the basics of white and black. And I've read a lot of different articles and we'll post all of them. But a couple of them have talked about how in ancient Greece, blue was not, there wasn't a word for it. So, like, if you were describing, like, the ocean, for example, in the Odyssey, the ocean is described as being wine dark.
Oh.
So it's way more about tonality and light and dark rather than actually being able to describe the color blue. And, I mean, this isn't surprising to me because I love ancient Egypt and I think that it's, like, one of the dopest periods, especially for art history, that the Egyptians were the first to really get into blue and start using blue and making blue pigments and created really the way of defining blue. And this came from the stone lapis lazuli. So lapis lazuli was used by the Egyptians about, 6,000 years ago. And Cleopatra actually used it as eyeshadow. So the stone was ground into like a fine powder and she used it as eyeshadow. And honestly, if Cleopatra was using it, you know it's fucking dope. Because it's Cleopatra.
She would. Like, oh, here's this new thing we've never seen before.
Yeah.
Let me put it on my face.
Yeah.
We should start a makeup brand. Based in art historical colors.
Ooh. Wow. Anyone who wants to sponsor us for that, let us know.
Or sponsor us in general. Just hit us up.
Yeah.
arthistorybabes@gmail.com.
Trademark.
Oh my God. Yeah, so the Egyptians were the first ones that really began playing with lapis lazuli and incorporating chemistry into that, where they were adding other, like they would add calcium or limestone into the lapis lazuli stone to create different shades of blue. And so this is where really the word for the color blue emerged. And then because of ancient Egypt's influence and position in the greater trade, this really spread to other parts of the world. And the stone itself, the lapis lazuli stone, I like want to get a ring or something with lapis lazuli because it's so, ooh, it's like such a beautiful, vibrant blue, and it has like flecks of different colors in it. And it really makes sense why later colors made from lapis lazuli were specifically geared towards religious figures, because the stone itself, it almost looks like you're looking at like a little world or like a kind of cosmos scene. Like, you know, you have these beautiful, yeah, ooh, it's such a beautiful, rich color. And with these little flecks in it, it kind of just looks like you're looking out at the universe in the stone. And so this is what kind of started the trend of different shades of blue carrying these deeper meanings of holy, expensive pigments that were made from the paints. So I've read this one particular book, and we'll post this on the website, and it's been really interesting. It's called Color, A Natural History of the Palette by Victoria Finlay, or Finlay. I like Finlay. I might be wrong, but it's got a bit more sass.
I think it's Finlay.
We already talked about a couple of our favorite podcasts that discuss color, and an additional one that I'm going to add to that list is our friends, like we know them. I'm just our friends. But Radiolab has an episode on colors. It's season 10, episode 13, if any of you want to check that out. And they too talk about, you know, kind of the science of colors and perception of colors. But they interview this author, Victoria Finlay, in there from this book. And so each chapter of her book has to do with a different color. And the chapter on blue is just fascinating. Looking at like how blue kind of started, and especially with lapis lazuli, blues made from the stone lapis lazuli in ancient Egypt, and that really spread to a lot of different parts of the world. China loved it. A lot of lapis lazuli mines are in Afghanistan, also Persia, Iran, and that this color really kind of spread out, like it exploded out as a color that was very expensive and very highly valued as being a color that was not only hard to find, hard to make, but was associated with wealth, royalty, and then later kind of like a sense of holiness. And this really comes in with Italy, and it sort of begins like in the early Renaissance, where, you know, the church decides to start color coding different saints and religious figures, and the Virgin Mary gets blue. So this is where we start seeing, you know, like her robes being painted in these like really rich blue colors. And this led me into the world of ultramarine. And ultramarine is so cool. It's so cool. So ultramarine, in the word itself, like ultramarine, so you think of the sea, so it's like, oh, these blues and greens. But when you look at ultramarine, which is made from lapis lazuli, it's really like very blue. There's not that much green in it. And so this is a confusion of the word. So in Italian, it stems from the word ultramarino, which basically just means from beyond the seas. And the Italians use this term not just specifically to lapis lazuli in this blue pigment paint. They meant it as more of a way of describing things that came from far beyond Italy. They came from beyond the seas. And this kind of leads to that mythos, enigmatic quality of this ultramarine color, which came from stones that were from very far away, primarily Afghanistan. And so that's where the word ultramarine comes from. It's also found in Chile, Zambia, Siberia, but Afghanistan is still to this day like the primary country where these mines of lapis lazuli are. And for painters, ultramarine was purchased by patrons. No artist could afford lapis lazuli, like not even the big time artists. And in this book that I read, Color by Victoria Finlay, she talks specifically about Michelangelo, and he did a painting of the Atonement, and this is actually in the British Museum now. I'm pretty sure it's the British Museum. I might be but I'm pretty sure. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure. Part of it is unfinished, and we'll post this image on the website so you can see it, but in the image, there is blank space in the lower right-hand corner, and you're like, what the fuck is that, Michelangelo? Like, what were you doing? like, what? And it was because it was meant to be the Virgin Mary, and he was going to paint her robes in ultramarine, but he didn't have enough money, and his patrons, like, you can imagine Michelangelo, and he was, by all accounts, a somewhat fiery kind of figure, writing to his patrons, being like, you know, fuck, like, give me money so I can get this ultramarine. You know, this shit's coming from Afghanistan. They need to mine it, and then they need to, like, break it down and mix it with minerals and water, and they need to get it to me, and I need to paint it, but I can't afford it myself.
So wait, that slight Italian accent.
I know. Yeah, so artists during this time, if they did not have patrons that had the means to buy this very, very expensive pigment, then they would have to resort to other shades of blue, or in Michelangelo's case, they would leave them blank.
I also want to point out just, like, how perfectly bitchy Michelangelo was to just leave that blank.
Right?
You know, because he could have painted it any other color.
He could have done other shades of blue.
He really could have. And he was like, you know what? No, fuck y'all.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
I want ultramarine.
Right.
He had such a little attitude, though. Like, my favorite is the whole anecdote about him, like, running away from the Sistine Chapel, yeah, like, multiple times. He's like, I'm not going to do this. He just, like, ran away, and then, like, the Pope would bring him back, and you'd be like, fuck! Yeah. It's so funny.
No, but, I mean, talking about how it's made, because I bookmarked a specific part in this color book where she talks about how the ultramarine is made from lapis lazuli. And so I'm just going to, like, read this little portion here. So lapis lazuli, this is not my voice. It's Victoria's Finlays. Victoria Finlays. So this
imagine quotation marks.
Yeah. Lapis lazuli is a complex clump of minerals, including hyune.
Good job.
Sodalite, nosian, and lazurite. In the best grades, there is more sulfur, the yellow element, curiously making the stone more violet. And in the worst case, And in the worst, that's my worst. No. and in the worst grades, there is more calcium carbonate, turning it gray. To make it into paint, all these impurities, including the sparkling pyrite stars. So those are, like, when you look in the lapis lazuli stone, those are what I was saying, kind of make it look like a universe. Mm-hmm. It's so cool. To achieve that, the color maker had to be a baker, lovingly kneading a dough of finely powdered lapis, resin, wax, gum, and linseed oil for up to 3 days.
Aww.
To coax out the blue, our artist cook put the dough into a bowl of lye, which is wood ash or water, and then kneaded it with 2 sticks, squeezing and pressing it for hours until the liquid was saturated with blue. They then separated the blue into a clean bowl and, leaving it to dry into a powdery pigment, started again with a fresh lye and the small ball of resin. So this was the whole process. So obviously it was not, you know, easy peasy. And the fact that it came typically from Afghanistan, distance and time equals cost, pretty much. And today, I mean, obviously, this is a rough estimate because it depends on how much you're ordering. But today, it could easily cost $3,000 to still get this ultramarine made from lapis lazuli. And this was really interesting because our last episode on the Bacchanal, Jen talked about Bacchus and Ariadne by Titian. And in this book on color, the author talks about that same painting and how Titian used ultramarine for the sky. And how perfect is that with the myth of Ariadne and Bacchus? And that this color was typically viewed during the Renaissance and even beyond the Renaissance as being a color that was, like, illustrious and beautiful and perfect and sort of beyond all others. And I was reading too about, like, okay, why then in, like, the English language is blue something that relates to, like, oh, I'm feeling blue, like, I'm sad or whatever. And part of it could be, I mean, this is speculation, but it could be that because this color was like one of the last colors in the English language, and it relates to the sky and it relates to the sea, that it kind of has something to do with beyondness, of something that is distant and maybe receding and therefore not as tangible as other colors, or maybe that relates to not tangible emotions. I don't know.
If I think that any sense, no, you totally that's are. Great but actually, way to try and that, explain it. Yeah, that was amazing, because that actually, when we've been talking about and thinking about colors in terms of emotion, it reminded me of the movie that came. It was last summer, Inside Out. Did you guys watch that at all?
I didn't see it.
I adored it so much.
Was that like the Pixar movie?
Amy Poehler, we love you.
Yeah, we love you so much. Oh, yeah. I didn't see it, but I heard it was really good.
It's amazing. It's this Pixar movie about emotions. It's super cute. It's so great. But what I think is so great about it is, just from like a psychological perspective, it really teaches kids a lot about emotion and how to deal with their emotions.
Sure.
But it also does kind of associate colors with emotions, like joy is yellow, blue is sadness. And what's so, so, so great about this movie, and I just, like, praise them so much for it, is that they really did this amazing job of making the audience realize that sadness is a useful emotion, that it has a purpose, and it, like, it might not be the most logical sometimes, but it's kind of like a bigger purpose.
Yeah, that it's like the secondary protagonist.
Yeah.
Like joy and sadness are basically like the two protagonists of the whole storyline, which is nice. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, and they are, and it's so great because in our society, joy is so, like, I mean, everyone wants everyone to be happy all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, it's such a value trait, and it is in the movie for quite a while, but then they did something really interesting, and they made sadness as this very important part of human experience. Mm-hmm. And they, and like I said, blue was attached to it. Like the sadness character was blue, and and they did this whole cool thing where sadness and joy wrapped together in certain memories and created this beautiful, like, yellow blue vortexy type image.
Interesting.
Yeah. I need to watch this.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's but awesome. It did this, like, it just did this really great thing of, like, kind of going off what you were saying, Ginny, about blue and sadness being this, like, kind of bigger thing. It, it kind of captured that in a certain way.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting insight into why blue is associated with sadness. I've never heard it put like that. Because according to most psychologists, they can't really figure it out.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody really knows why we associate blue and, like, black with, you know, black is associated with, like, ominous or evil, and blue is associated with somber or sadness.
And then you get into, like, cultural differences, which gets so complicated. And
it's there's this article from The Guardian, but it is discussing a 1931 study done by a Dr. Siegfried Katz of New York State Psychiatric Institute. So he published a study in the Journal of Applied Psychology, and it was called Color Preference in the Insane. So this is, you know, obviously before politically correct terminology. We don't call them the insane today, but we know what this means. Dr. Katz tested 134 hospitalized patients with mental health problems, and he limited the testing to six colors: red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and violet. No black, no white, no shades of gray. And had the patients choose which color they liked the best. Interestingly, the most popular color was blue. Yeah, second popular colors in men were green. Women patients were divided between green, red, or violet as a second choice. Also, patients with the most marked mental deterioration, their color preferences shifted towards green and yellow. So,
interesting.
Very interesting. And 38% of schizophrenics and manic depressives gave their first preference to blue, and 42% of all of their patients.
That reminds me of the pinnacle of meditation, like almost when you've reached enlightenment, quote unquote. apparently you see just like a really intense blue, and it's supposed to
blue is like blowing my mind.
I know. It's supposed to kind of represent God in some ways, and it and it's an experience, like this is a documented experience by many people who have gotten really deep into meditation. Blue ends up being the color that they experience.
Oh, well, isn't blue nearest to the highest chakra?
Yes.
Yeah, where the blue chakra, which is the third eye chakra, is awareness. And then the crown chakra is purple, and that is spirituality.
Purple prince, that makes sense.
Yes.
We've got it because all figured out.
Honestly, I was torn between blue and purple, mostly purple because I love Prince.
Well, and Prince was obviously the highest level of enlightenment.
He was obviously released from the brutal cycle of Moshka and achieved nirvana as a perfect, perfect purple prince. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Picasso's blue period. It was a short period in Spanish, periodo azul. Spanish painter Pablo Picasso, between 1901 and 1904, was painting these monochromatic shades of blue works. And these works, they were inspired by Spain. He painted in Barcelona and in Paris, and they are some of his most popular works and one of the most popular periods of an artist that we know about. I can't think of very many other artists that we have popularized one of their periods.
Like, for sure.
You know what I mean? No, but I feel like even the layman art historian knows about the blue period. So the works are characterized by a somber, austere subject matter. So prostitutes, beggars, drunks, these were frequent subjects. And what is known about the blue period is that Picasso was influenced by a journey that he was taking through Spain after the suicide of his friend Carlos Casagemas. So this was a good friend of Picasso's, and Picasso would later recall that he started painting in blue when he learned of Casagemas' death. So there's been a lot of push by art historians and psychologists alike wanting to associate the blue palette with this psychology behind this moment of losing his very good friend. It should also be noted that Picasso wasn't there when Casagemas committed suicide, but when he returned to Paris in May, he stayed in the studio of his departed friend and worked for several weeks on an exhibition that he was going to have of these works. They were hugely popular, but Picasso's psychological state worsened, and he sank into a severe depression. So during these next 3 years, most of his work was dominated by blue tones. There isn't a whole lot that we know about why he then moved on from his blue period. Maybe he just got out of it, but it's very interesting to note that after the blue period, he had a rose period. Did we know about the rose period? Yeah. I never heard about the rose period. I know about the rose period now. And interestingly enough, his psychological state improved by all accounts, and he began to work on more joyful, vibrant works. And he emphasized the use of pinks and other warm hues, and that expressed a shift in mood and in subject matter. So, classical, he got depressed, he went blue, and then all of a sudden he went all pink and rosy.
Rose-tinted glasses.
So what is this? Why is that a thing? I don't know.
I don't know either. It's really interesting too that like blue can associate with kind of a depressed state, but it also is very much related to feelings of calm. Right? And what does that say?
I think that about our emotions. Yeah.
What does that say that like blue and depression and blue and calm are so closely related? So I'll just end on some very non-psychological, really quickly, the color cobalt. Cobalt stems off of ultramarine. Cobalt, interestingly enough, means goblin. stemming from the German word kobold, spelled with a K. And this is because it's made from metal. And so this metal attracts a form of arsenic, which is obviously poisonous. And so this grew into the term of like, oh, it's kobold. It's a gremlin. It's very dangerous to us, but it makes this color blue. And this also relates to the color Prussian blue, which can also, depending on how you mix it, be kind of dangerous and poisonous. But then a new pigment of blue was discovered in 2009 by some chemists, not surprisingly, brilliant people, specifically Mas Subramanian. I'm most likely pronouncing that incorrectly. I do apologize. I tried my best. And so this came from a series of tests, and scientists were mixing black manganese. Thank you. I want to pronounce everything like I'm Italian, like manganese. I am Italian, but anyways, oxide with a variety of chemicals, and it was heated to like 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and this created this new blue, and it is such a vibrant, beautiful blue.
I want it in my hair.
Oh, it's so pretty. And what is really...
in your hair.
And what's very cool about this blue, because beyond ultramarine, a lot of these other really vibrant blues, I talked about like cobalt and Prussian blue, can be toxic. But this new blue, which is called Yinmin, which is stemming from like the chemistry,
the periodic table.
Yeah. So they're combining that in the name. So this is more durable, safe, and fairly easy to produce. And it appears to be a new candidate for energy efficiency. And this would mean that if a roof were painted in this specific shade of blue, it could potentially keep that whatever building that was cooler. So not only is it not toxic, but it could be energy efficient, and it's
amazing.
A beautiful, beautiful color of blue.
Magic blue.
And a lot of blues have been discovered accidentally. Prussian blue was one such case. So blue, it's fascinating. I had such a great time with this.
We're going to kind of wrap up this episode with a little bit of listener mail. What do we got, Natalie?
All right. So our first listener mail comes from our fellow art history babe, Amanda. And goes as reads. Reads as.
Yes. How do you say that? That sounds great. Okay. Yes.
Goes as reads. Why not?
Dear AH babes, I love your podcast. And in reference to the Gorilla Girls episode, you mentioned how there is a history around hysteria and women thinking with emotion that are connected to their genitalia. Do you think it is acceptable in turn for women to accuse men of thinking with their penis? And to all of you lovely feminists in the podcast, have you ever personally accused a man of thinking with his genitalia? Great questions.
Very interesting.
So I personally have not ever accused a man of thinking with his dick. Let's just say dick, okay? This is an adult podcast. Yeah.
Thank you for being proper, but we're just going to tweak that.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. The word penis is just so
too
clinical.
Yeah.
And anyway, no, I have never accused a man of thinking with his dick because I feel like not even has there ever even been an idea of like, no, I can't do that because I wouldn't want a man to accuse me of being hysterical because of my genitalia. It just seems absurd to accuse somebody of thinking with their genitals. I mean,
well, the whole idea of thinking with your genitals, I mean, if you really wanted to look at that from a feminist perspective, that could go either way because, I mean, it is true. Sometimes people act in a certain way because they're trying to achieve certain sexual desires.
Yeah, they want to have sex.
Yeah, they want to have sex. So they might act a certain way because they want to have sex. But I feel like if you're really looking at that as like a liberated feminist, that could go either way. Like a girl can act a certain way because she wants to have sex, the same way a guy can act a certain way because he wants to have sex. Whereas with the instance of hysteria, that was a little bit more of an institutionalized idea of women being hysterical because their lady parts made them that way.
Well, you know, why they were that way is because they were horny. No, I'm just kidding.
Men didn't know how to pleasure.
No. But seriously, that's, I'm being silly.
Facetious.
Yes. Yeah. But no, seriously though, that term originated around Victorian times,
yeah,
which historically were very repressed times. And I think that it's safe to say that maybe some women didn't know how to communicate that they had sexual needs. And I think that when all of the doctors are male and everything is run by men, it's very easy to give it a name, especially during the age of, it seems like during Victorian times, an abundance of mental hospitals pops up.
Definitely.
That's like the golden age of mental institutions.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising that doctors would want to give it a clinical term. So I think there was a lot of factors that went into play in coining the term hysteria. But yeah, from a modern day point of view, and as a feminist, I think that part of being a feminist is treating men with respect. Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Yeah, and not stereotyping anyone regardless of their gender. And I mean, I don't know that I've ever used it. I can't think of a time. I've definitely had the thought, but in more of like flippant terms. Like, oh, yeah, it's like boys will be boys, like the stupid shit that people say that makes no sense.
Boys will be boys is the worst.
Yeah, it's an expression that just gets
fuck boys will be boys.
Yeah.
Fuck
there's
boys.
So many things
raise
wrong
raise boys
with
and
them.
Girls the same way.
Yeah, but it's like one of those terms that just kind of gets get used to hearing it, so you don't really think much about it, but
yeah,
I like the comparison of that to women's hysteria.
I do too. Definitely. I mean, because it's definitely problematic.
It's not okay to just claim that men think with their penises any more than a woman thinks with her vagina.
And I mean, even when you think about it in those kind of terms, like if you're thinking with a body part that is other than your brain, can we even say that fairly? Because you can think with your brain like, oh, I would like to have sex.
Yeah.
And that is not necessarily all controlled by your vagina or your penis. That is, your mind being like, well, I would like to have sex.
Exactly. Yeah, it's an overly simplistic phrase.
Yeah.
Because, the whole, like,
and thinking that way is totally fine.
Yeah. Like, you can think, your genitalia can
control you.
can suggest some things, but you can still stop and, like, think about it logically and be like, well, yeah, I still want to have sex. And do that as a logical human being, female or male. So I definitely do think it could be a little bit of a double standard in certain circumstances, but I think it's just important to not.
There's nuances that differentiate the problem of hysteria from the phrase
yes.
thinking with your penis.
Yeah, and because I don't think any male was ever put into a mental institution
exactly.
and given electroshock therapy because he
I don't
wanted
know
to have
what
sex.
Happened with Tiger Woods, but he might have something to say on the side.
Oh,
God.
Did they shock him?
I don't know.
Tiger Woods, are you okay?
But yeah, that was a great question. Very interesting question.
We thought about that for sure.
And we appreciate all listener questions and listener mail.
Ask us more questions.
Yeah, ask us all the questions you want. We love talking about it.
And someone find out what happened to Tiger Woods.
Where is he? What is he doing?
But the best way to reach us, arthistorybabes@gmail.com. As we have also mentioned on every other episode, we're on all the social media.
Everyone.
So find us if you want to support us. Rating us and giving us reviews has been lovely.
That's the best thing you can do for us.
Seriously, all the great reviews we have gotten has like legitimately
made Corey cry.
Emotional.
Yeah, it's made Corey cry.
We have seen the tears.
Which granted, it's not super hard to do, but also it means a lot.
It does. It means a lot to all of us. We really, really appreciate it. Like, honestly, the amount of support we have gotten has been pretty crazy. So thank you so much. But thanks for listening, and tune in next time for Color Theory Part 2.
Part deuce.
Where we'll be talking about Joseph Albers and color theory and some more psychology business.
We'll talk a little bit about some Van Gogh.
Van Gogh.
Mark Rothko.
Ooh.
Oh, baby.
But thanks for listening, and we'll catch you later.
Ciao, ciao.
Bye.
I'm Cabernet Dumont. They're here to slay the art history, babe.
Love Prince.
Well, and Prince was obviously the highest level of enlightenment.
He was obviously released from the brutal cycle of Moshka and achieved nirvana as a perfect, perfect purple Prince.
The Art History Babes podcast is made possible by support from our lovely listeners via Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/arthistorybabes to help keep the Art History Babes going and for access to bonus content.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.